Bob McCallum. It's John Shannon. This is the Bob McCallum podcast. I'm exhausted from all these best ofs.
Are you? Why?
I may have to take another week off.
Then we won't be doing best ofs next week.
Front office people.
Take it or leave it. It'll be called.
Yeah. Two GMs and a president. Kyle Dubas, the president, or no, the general manager, of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Ron Francis, the general manager of the Seattle Kraken, all on the same program.
All dealing with the same issues.
Here we go on the best of the Bob McCallum podcast. McCallum and Shannon back with you, and joining us this day, the general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs, Kyle Dubas, is with us. How you doing? How's your summer been?
It's been fast, Bob. Thank you. But we're back up and rolling. Start our development camp here in Toronto today with our young players and rookies, and off to Traverse City, Michigan next week for the rookie tournament hosted by Detroit, and less than 2 weeks away from training camp day one. So summer is effectively over, and we're on to the 21-22 season.
I guess the fair question is how agonizing has summer been?
There's just been so much, John. We finished on May 31st, obviously hugely disappointing. And then you're right into your preparation for expansion. We had a number of staff hires to make here on the coaching side at all levels. So, that took, it's been interesting how fast it's gone by, which I think given the way that the season ended is a good thing. Goes by fast and you get a chance to pick yourself up and get back at it again quickly and get rolling. But between the staff changes and expansion draft and free agency through July, I think it's gone by very, very quick. So the agony happened early and then you have to dust yourself off and get back at it.
Actually, you talked about staff changes. I think people forget that Dave Hakstol, the new Seattle coach, was on your staff the last couple of years, and you've hired Dean Chanuth. What will Hakstol's absence change in your planning?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably a question that Sheldon could better answer. But having gone through that process with him, in replacing Hack on our staff. And then we added Dean Chanuth to replace Hack. So Dean comes from Carolina, where he did a really, really good job with their defense and with their penalty kill. And so our hope is that it is as seamless as possible. I think whenever you lose anybody from any enterprise, you're hoping you can replace them with someone as good or better. And Hack is obviously one of the best in hockey at what he was doing with us. And that's earned him the chance to get back into the lead chair with Seattle. So for us, it's trying to replace what he did here with our defense and the penalty kill with the best person we could find. And we're fortunate to be able to have Dean join us. And then we also added Spencer Carberry, who's the head coach and the AHL coach of the year last year at Hershey. So that he'll round out the staff in addition to Manny Malhotra, who returned. So we're excited about where we're at and where we're going with the coaching staff. For me, most excited I've been about our coaching staff in my time here overall.
With Kyle Dubas, the evaluation process for you as a general manager is a 12-month deal. I understand that. It happens every day, every hour, really. You're constantly evaluating where you're at, how your players are performing, what things you may need or want, et cetera, et cetera. But how do you evaluate the success of the regular season versus the disappointment of the playoffs? And how much weight do you put on one versus the other?
Well, I think in the end, Bob, our goal is to win the Stanley Cup. So when we don't, that can only be achieved in the playoffs. And when we don't reach that in the playoffs, I think you have to be very realistic and objective and say that you fell short. One of the things that we've tried to focus on is that if, especially now going back into the Atlantic Division, if we do not have our focus set on having a great regular season and building up the habits that we're going to need to have playoff success in the regular season, we're going to be in difficult there. So I think everyone in our organization knows we're going into the season We're going to be going head to head with Tampa. They've won the Stanley Cup 2 years in a row. Boston is a perennial contender. Florida was one of the best teams in the league last season. They lost to Tampa in the playoffs in a great series. You've got Montreal in the division. They obviously beat us. They went to the Stanley Cup final. And then you have Ottawa that's been very open about what their aspirations are and the way that they finished last season, and the job that Pierre and DJ have done there is that they aspire to be a playoff contender as well. So you've got six teams in our division that are very open about what their aspirations are in terms of playoffs. And one of those teams for sure in our conference would miss and thus be greatly disappointed. So I think for us, that lets us really hone in on the fact that if we don't have a great regular season, we're not going to set ourselves up to get to the playoffs, and you can't just get there and flip a switch anyway. So it is greatly important. That said, I think we all know in our organization, players, coaches, management, everybody, that our team has to begin to have success in the playoffs, that the fans and media alike are not going to be overly satisfied by another, you know, record-setting regular season. They want us to win the Stanley Cup. That requires winning 4 playoff rounds. And so in my role, you try to keep the focus on the day-to-day and what's required to have success in the long run, in terms of what you need to do day-to-day to get there, but also know that we need to set ourselves up to have success when we do get there and break through, which we haven't done yet.
Do you think that, and this is a difficult question to ask, but do you think this is your last chance to do that? I mean, you've been here 7 years now.
This is my 8th season, John. Yeah, and so going into the 4th as general manager, I never think about things that way, but I also don't shy away from the question either. And I think that it's certainly fair to ponder, and especially given the fact that we're going to return the same core group, which I have great belief in. If I didn't have belief in it, knowing the consequences to the team, we wouldn't have returned it. But I think it's certainly fair to say that if there aren't changes to our performance in the end, that there will be changes to the organization. And I think that comes with the territory of operating in a market like this and operating with a team that hasn't reached its potential in the playoffs thus far.
Is there anything out of the player exit interviews you can share that some people may not have heard about over the summertime?
Sure. I thought, John, that the players, especially after the season, so we lost, I think it was a Monday night, Tuesday, I think everyone just took the day, and then Wednesday we did our team photo and exit interviews. It was the most accountable that I've heard the players, just in terms of what their role was in us falling short in the playoffs. And it was also the most adamant that I'd heard them about the fact that they believe in themselves and they believe that this group will push through. And I know no one wants to hear that right now, and they don't want to hear us say anything. They want to see us go out and do it. And mm-hmm. and I understand that. I appreciate it. But to me, it was a good sign from our group that they were very, very open about what their responsibility was, and the fact that we had the lead in the series 3-1 and we weren't able to get that 4th win. And also the fact that they have a deep belief in this group being able to get there, and that they were going to back up those words with their actions over the summer and their training and how they came into the regular season. And, you know, we're still, just under 2 weeks away, and we mostly have every player in our facility each day, which we've never had before. And I think that to me shows a great level of commitment and how serious they are about this upcoming season. And the fact that I think there are rightfully a lot of doubts about whether this team can do it, and they're going to get to proving themselves and our organization right, starting on October 13th.
As you look back on that playoff series with Montreal, what was it in your mind that caused your team to lose the last 3 games and ultimately lose the series? Was there a specific thing? Was it a confidence factor? What kind of happened in your mind?
I think games 5 and 6 were very similar, Bob. I think that in both of those games, Montreal came out, they got the lead, and then we stormed all the way back. And I thought we played really, really well. We pushed back in the games when we could have went quietly into the night, tied both games. We're down 3 in game 5 and down 2 in game 6 on the road, came back, tied the games, had chances in game 5 to win it in regulation, had copious number of chances in game six and overtime to win it as well. Puck didn't go in, and so that set us up for game seven. I thought game seven for us was a totally different set of circumstances and a different mindset that ailed us. I thought in game seven, we were passive and we were a little bit, we were on our heels. We went it into the middle of the ring in a championship do or die fight. And we really went in and allowed ourselves to feel out the opponent rather than go and assert ourselves and get on our toes and attack it and assert our style of play, which has sort of been the thing that I think that's ailed us. If you look back at all those similar games, if you go back to Columbus, 2020, Boston, in 18 and 19, and Washington even in game six, 2017. So that to me was sort of the same type of thing that has hindered us in the past shining through there. And I think that is the one thing we need to change. When everything is on the line, are we going to be able to be at our best and assert ourselves? And I think the only way we can get through that is openly talk about it, not try to dance around the fact that it doesn't exist, and just lean into that criticism and reality and go right through it.
You know, you talk about that, and game seven was it, the guys appeared to be afraid to lose. But this is a team that over the last two or three years has been in this, as you talked about, in this same position. And how do you get over the fact of being afraid to lose? Some of these guys aren't teenagers anymore. No. And they have to push through that.
I agree with you, John. I think we have to help them as an organization through it. And I think the way that we go through it is, you know, last year as we went to the playoffs, there was the narrative coming out of our room and organization was that we were different. This year was different. And I think when you tell everybody that, they're largely going to say, okay, we might believe you because the regular season has shown that so far, but you're really going to only know that when the pressure amps up and you have to go through that crucible of, you know, the biggest test. And in that moment, we reverted back to what the team has been before. And I think rather than dance around it and rather than look back on it, we have to look ahead and say, we're going to be tested in that way again. And this is what's happened in all these different times when we've done it. How are we going to change it? And I think the way that you start to change it when something's an issue is you confront it, you talk about it, you're open about it. You don't try to hide from something that's uncomfortable or something that has ailed your team in the past and limited its ability to reach its potential. You have to look right at it and go right at it. And that to me is, you know, what Sheldon, the coaching staff, and what all of our conversations and management with the players and the coaching staff with the players and the players amongst each other have been about this off season. So I know that everyone will be looking at the year and asking themselves, okay, they could have whatever regular season they want, but how are they going to respond mm-hmm. in those moments? And that will be the ultimate test for our team. I think what everybody here is looking forward to, but in order to get to that point, we have to have a great regular season first.
Well, one of the things that happens regularly, Kyle, and as you would attest, is a general manager evaluates the strengths and weaknesses of his club, especially at the end of the season. And one of the questions you would ask yourself is, well, where do we need help? Where can we be better? And with the cap being what it is, with the cost of your current roster being where it is, your flexibility, your ability to be flexible is very much limited. We understand that, which leaves you with the potential of a trade. Do you, and the question I'm sure you asked yourself at some point and within the organization, within your group, is there a move we can make that we don't really want to make, but will help our team? And almost inevitably that move would be a core player. And how seriously did you contemplate that possibility?
I think we looked at everything, Bob, and we look at everything regardless. I know that there's a sort of a feeling that the core group is protected and we have a strong belief in them, but I think we would look at anything that would improve our team overall. Like regardless, I think the time for sentiment and different things like that have come and gone as the years have gone past where we haven't broken through to what many deem is our potential. Now, none of those opportunities we felt came along in the summer where it was going to tangibly improve our team. It would have made us different, but it wouldn't have necessarily made us better. And in the end, the decision was from my end that you know, regard whether the team has reached its potential or not, or whether there's a huge amount of doubt around the team, I have an incredible amount of belief in the talent of the group, of the core group, and in who they are as people. And I also would have come to appreciate over my brief time in this league and studying others is that if you really believe in something and it doesn't go necessarily the way you want right away, it's in those moments where you're staring down the barrel of a high amount of pressure and criticism and doubt that you really, your belief really truly gets tested. And that's how I feel about our group here. And I'm excited for them to pick themselves back up and get back at it in a few weeks and get into the season. And if things come up along the way that can improve our team, that's the job. And we'll be aggressive in trying to do that. But at this moment, none of those things have come across where I felt our team would be better. It might've satisfied the masses and the team might've looked different, but there was nothing that came across from the day that we ended the season against Montreal till today where I felt that we would have been absolutely better. And in the end, that's the position I'm in, is to try to find those opportunities, not just something that will make us different and potentially, you know, give me some room to breathe amongst the public or the media.
Are you tough enough?
I think that's always a question of every team. I think the game is so different now. We went into the off season and, you know, the players that we acquired in free agency, especially John, I think bring those different elements. We, you know, we brought back Wayne Simmons. We acquired Nick Ritchie. I think Nick is, you know, he's a good player and he can score. He can play up and down the lineup, but he's also, you know, he's also a very, very tough young man in the way that he plays. Michael Bunting, we he's a local player. We signed him from Arizona. You know, he's not got a long fight record or anything like that, and that really doesn't matter to us. But in terms of how he competes, where he scores, the areas that he's able to get to, that was what was really important to us. And then signing David Kampf, you know, he's someone that we feel can take on a huge responsibility defensively up front. So in terms of the players that we signed, we certainly looked at their competitiveness or toughness or whatever you want to call it. And that was really, really important to us in terms of how they played, how hard they played, where they were able to have their success as players around the net defensively and such. And so, you know, we're happy with where we went there. We've obviously lost, you know, Zach Hyman, who is a very competitive player, but that's going to happen with, as Bob alluded to earlier, with where the cap is. Mm-hmm. You're going to have, if you want to be a competitive team and you want to contend, I think every contending team last year has lost a number of core players that were free agents. And I think you're going to see more and more of that because you can't just extend the players and hope that you're going to figure out the cap stuff later if the cap isn't going to go anywhere. So you're going to see a lot more guys playing out their UFA seasons.
Is the criticism that you that is out there that you have designed a great regular season team but not a great playoff team, is that fair?
I think it's fair for that, John, until we show that we can have success in the playoffs. I think there have been a number of teams over the years in hockey and other sports that have dealt with, that have been levied with that same accusation and claim. And you can fight it and you can try to refute it and you can get sensitive about it. You can say, you know, geez, it's until we show we can win in the playoffs, it's right. And it's up to us to go out and prove that. It's not on anybody in the public to defend us or to shelter us from that claim. We have to go out and do it. And until we do, I think the criticism is fair. It's on us and only us to prove that we can. And until we do, I think it's certainly fair of anybody to ask any questions they have or to really ask whether we can. And so I have no issue with that at all.
John raised the issue, Kyle, of the physical presence on this team. And traditionally what we see happen and what I think you've done is you go out and try and get a couple of guys that are significantly physical. I guess the question I have is, can you take your core who are not known to be physical players and ask them to be more physical? And if you can achieve that, isn't that a much better solution than having one or two guys who go out there and try and bang somebody?
I think as with anything, Bob, whatever is accomplished will be our core guys elevating themselves. And they're still so young, with the exception of John, and Morgan. I think they're all still in their early 20s. Now the sun is setting on the early portion of their 20s, but that's where they're at. And I think last year, to speak specifically about Austin, I thought he took big steps in how hard he played and how he competed all throughout the rink. And I thought that led him to be one of the more dominant players in the league. I thought in the playoffs, he continued with that same style of play. The puck just didn't go in for him. William Nylander in the playoffs, especially, I don't think these or anybody's core group are ever going to run anybody over. I mean, when I look at Tampa, I think that their core players are tough. I thought Montreal's core players, whether it was last year, Deneau and Gallagher, I think they're tough and they're physical, but it's not running around, running people over. I think right. It's how hard do you work to protect the puck and keep it and get to the middle of the ice and score when it's hard to do that. And how hard do you work to get the puck back? And I think our guys, particularly Austin and William, showed huge signs of progress there last year, especially Austin. I think that's what propelled him into the conversation, right in behind McDavid when it came to the Hart Trophy and different things of that nature. Mitch Marner with our club has been on our penalty kill and a big part of our defensive units his whole time here. And so he's always had that element in my mind. And I think that's what makes him a special talent in addition to his scoring. So I think our guys just need to get, they look around the league and they see teams that have been faced with these same questions and core groups that have been faced with these same questions having success. And I think it's a great way for our people and our players to learn, Bob. But I think, as they're still young, they need to continue to push and develop. And in the end, they have to take those steps, but it's on us to push them to get there. So sure. We have a responsibility there and they have one. And I think that with the way last season ended, this year, more than any other year, I would expect to see massive evolution in everybody as we continue to push to try to win.
We're with Kyle Dubas, and we'll take a quick break and come back with more after this message. Bob McCowan, John Shannon, and the general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs, Kyle Dubas. You earlier alluded to, you mentioned Tavares. Of course, as Leaf fans well know, last time we saw him, he had that concussion issue. Give us some kind of an update. Do you expect everything to be fine with Tavares with relation to that injury this year?
Yeah, I expect so, Bob, but it's the type of injury where unlike something purely physical, I don't think you truly know until someone gets back at it and fully immersed back into practice and exhibition games and such. So all seems to be good. John feels great. He's in the facility working and skating each day, and he looks great. And I know he's worked his butt off in the summer to continue to build on the way that he finished last year for us. And so I'm excited to see him up and rolling. And he's obviously a massive part of our team as our captain and as a center. And so certainly hopeful that our major concern is always with an injury of that nature is his health in the long run. And so it's protecting that, but we're now 3 months past it and all seems to be going smoothly.
Well, the National Hockey League welcomes a new member this season. I don't have to tell anybody about that. I think everybody's been well aware of it. Seattle finally gets their NHL team named the Kraken. And Ron Francis joins us to chat a little bit about this. Have you become comfortable with the Kraken name, Mr. Francis?
I love the Kraken name. Yeah, I'm more than comfortable with it.
Well, how involved were you in the process of making the decision?
Actually, I was fortunate. Todd Lewicki, our president, had me involved right from day one in the selection of the name, and then rolled over from there into the design of the logo and the jerseys and so on and so forth. So, right from the early stages, I was a part of it and really happy with the name we landed on.
That's interesting. You don't see Hockey Ops guys get too involved in that. So that must have been very satisfying to feel that you were being allowed to give in your 2 cents and maybe you can see a little bit of it in their new sweaters.
Yeah, no, it was exciting. And then, I've got kids that are kind of in the late 20s. So I was able to sort of incorporate them into the process to make sure that, the old man wasn't sort of off his rockers and some of the thought process to get some sort of a younger, fresher look at it from my kids too. So it was a really cool process to be involved in and be able to incorporate them in the process as well.
So give us a little bit of the behind the scenes on this. And, you know, I've been in a cursory way involved in with some franchises when names were came up. And often the franchises like to say, well, the fans chose it. When was the first time you heard the name Kraken? And do you remember who suggested it? Or did it come? Did it actually come from the fan base?
Yeah, I think before I got here, they had sent out sort of almost a competition, and they received, I want to say it was like 1,100 different names and variations. And then as a group, they tried to narrow it down and narrow it down again. So Kraken was one of the names I had heard when I first came on board and was a part of it. We were kind of leaning in a little bit of a different direction with some different names. I remember having a conversation with a young lady that worked for us, Heidi Detmar at the time. And I said, Heidi, explain to me about the Kraken. What does that mean to you and stuff? And she's from the area, and she talked about her grandparents and the folklore of the Kraken, and how these extremely intelligent animals live in the Puget Sound. And so I listened to her kind of story, and, you know, I was talking with Todd Lywicki, our president, and a couple of days later, and he said, you know, which one are you leaning towards? I said, I'm leaning towards Kraken. And he said, really? And told him about the story with Heidi. And so that, you know, it was sort of in the mix as we moved forward. And then, you know, as we kept working through it and trying to figure out a logo that matched with a name, you know, the one thing for us was making sure our logo was more along the lines of iconic than gimmicky. And I think with the work of Adidas and our ownership, we were able to accomplish that for sure.
Ron, the interesting thing about your involvement during the COVID time was a lot of it was done remotely. How much of a challenge was that through this process?
Yeah, I mean, it was a challenge in a lot of different aspects, John. I mean, we sent all our people home. I think it was in early February of 2000 that year. So we sent everybody home. We're working remotely ever since. And, you know, you're trying to do these meetings via Zoom. So, you know, is the color really accurate or is it not? Is the logo really what it looks like in person or not? So, you know, it wasn't just on the design of the logo, it was everything we did, even hiring the staff and personnel. I mean, a lot of those interviews were done on the phone or on Zoom, and then you're hiring people that you didn't get to meet till, you know, 12, 14 months later, finally when we had the expansion draft in person.
I don't need to tell you or anybody else out there. You know, Seattle has a baseball team, one that's actually in a race with the Toronto Blue Jays for a playoff spot. A very good football team, have been very good for a number of years. Had a basketball team for many years, and now an NHL franchise. How do you look upon the relationship between your team and the existing two major professional franchises in Seattle? Is it a competition, or are there things you can work together on?
Yeah, no, I think the relationships are great. You know, my president, my boss, Todd Lywicki, was part of the Seahawks and getting that up and running. He has strong relationships with the Mariners ownership there. The Sounders, the pro soccer team here, right. One of our owners here is the owner of that, Adrian Hanauer. So we have good relationships with the other pro sports team in town, and they've been great to reach out with and have dialogue with. And as we've sort of moved through this process, and it's sort of a give and take, and everybody's willing to help each other, which is exciting, especially in this market, us being the new guy in the block coming into it.
Do you get a sense of what kind of sports town Seattle is now, Ronnie? As it's, I mean, you were in Raleigh, where it's a college town, and Pittsburgh, it's, you know, this with the Steelers and the Pirates, and Hartford before that. What kind of sports town do you think Seattle is?
Oh, it's a huge sports town. You know, I love telling the story. I mean, the league said to our ownership group, you've got 6 weeks to get 10,000 season ticket deposits. And we accomplished that in 12 minutes. I mean, 12 minutes to get 10,000 season ticket deposits. And then we ended up with, I think it was 25,000 in the first hour and 32,000 the first day, had to cut it off. So we have another waiting list of people that want to get onto the waiting list for tickets. That's a huge number as well. So, and you watch the, you know, when the Sounders play and the people, you know, parading through the streets as they head to the soccer stadium, and the Seahawks and the 12th man and the raising of the flag, and the Mariners now, you know, back in the hunt and in the drive. I mean, it is a huge sports town, and it's, you know, it's more along the lines, I guess, when I was in Pittsburgh with the Steelers and the Pirates and that kind of stuff. But excited to be in this market, and excited to bring hockey back to this market. People are really excited to watch the first game.
Sounds like you should have built a bigger arena.
We could have put more people in.
Well, it raises, it's kind of a stupid question, but you know, what's the biggest arena in the NHL now, John?
Montreal.
It used to be Chicago, right?
Yeah, I think it was Chicago or Montreal, I think.
So that's around 20 or a little, maybe a tad over 20.
Yeah.
Like, how big could you go? I wonder. What's the biggest arena you could realistically build without angering the guys sitting up in the nosebleed section? I mean, could you go 25, Ronnie? Do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I know that when they do the one at the Big House there in Michigan, the outdoor game, but I'm sure some of those seats were not great at watching the ice. But you know, I know in our building we're right around 17-1. But it's a real intimate setting. You walk in on the main level, there's only about 30 rows up. Everything else is sort of subterranean. And you know, it's kind of a little bit of a steeper pitch. I think it's going to be an intimate setting. And I think there really isn't a bad seat in the house. Even the people in the so-called nosebleeds are going to have great views of the ice. So I think that's important too, making sure that people get a great view for the money they're spending as well.
What kind of role? For those that have been to Seattle, what part of the city is the arena in?
So our main rink is right next to the Space Needle. It's on that Seattle campus. It is the old Key Arena, but want to make it perfectly clear, it is a brand new arena. They they kept the roof because it was historically a historical structure back from the World Fair back in 1962. Right. Everything else was ripped out. They dug down in the ground, built a brand new state-of-the-art arena from the ground up. And then Amazon put the Climate Pledge arena name on top of it with the goal of making our arena the first ever net carbon zero arena by 2023-24. So pretty interesting facility.
And what kind of role did you have in developing the innards of that arena?
So on the Climate Pledge arena, they said, here's your 15,000 square feet that you have for your locker room. And Ricky Olchek and I flew to Kansas City, met with the architects from Populous and basically designed that from the ground up. Thought we were done and then started getting carpet samples and paint samples and tile samples. And, you know, so we went through that whole process. But, you know, and then on the flip side, we had the same thing with our Kraken Community Iceplex here that Starbucks has sponsored. You know, we built a three-sheet arena with a 18,000 square foot locker room there. Our offices are situated above the locker room. And Dave Tippett was here before me, had done a lot of work on filling that out. But and then when I came in, we kind of worked on making some tweaks. And again, same thing, had to fill out all the carpets and paints and you name it. But it's certainly a lot of work when you're in the middle of it. But now that it's complete, it's pretty exciting to say you were part of that for sure.
Boy, it doesn't hurt to have corporate partners, big names like Starbucks, headquartered Seattle, Amazon, headquartered in Seattle. I'm sure the guys at Microsoft are knocking on the door too to try to figure out what to do and how to be involved. The one thing about Seattle as a market, Ron, the league has always said that hockey fans are above the norm when it comes to tech savvy, and Seattle's a tech savvy city. Do you see that in anything what you're doing right now with your hockey club?
Yeah, absolutely, John. I mean, our goal is to, in some of the spaces we have in our arena, to incorporate sort of the Amazon, sort of the touchless system. We just walk in, you're already pre-registered, pick out what you want and walk out. You don't have to stop and pay in line and stuff. We are in the process of building and creating our own app. I think we'll be the first pro sports team for sure in the NHL that has designed its own app that you know, fans can pre-register again coming in and a lot of things they can do, a lot of stats they can follow during the game, all via their link on this app. Everything from parking and traffic to ticketing to sales and merchandise to ordering drinks and food to, you know, things that are happening on the ice. So it's pretty cool, a lot of things that they're developing that I think will be unique to the NHL at this point.
With Ron Francis of the Seattle Kraken, John and I've had numerous conversations with George McPhee over the years, from when he took over in Vegas. And, we can get into this a little bit more in terms of the comparisons, but one of the things that they did is they built their practice arena in Summerlin. And I used to live in Vegas, so I'm familiar with where it is, and it's basically essentially a residential community. And what's happened is the players, most of them wind up buying or renting or whatever they do in the area. So they're literally minutes away from the practice arena. Were you able to do that with yours?
No, we didn't put it in a residential area. We took an old sort of mall area called Northgate. And that's where we kind of built our facility, tore down some structures. I think in time you'll see this kind of develop into whether it's, you know, movie theaters and residential apartments and restaurants and all that kind of stuff and sort of redo the whole neighborhood in that regard. But at this point, that is not the case. But it's 7 miles north of where our big rink is. And I think our guys will live. There's so many different unique little sort of areas in Seattle that you can live. Some will live in Queen Anne, which is 5 minutes from the big rink and 10 minutes from the practice. Others will probably live across in Bellevue, which is probably, you know, 12 minutes from the practice facility and, you know, 15 to 20 from the big rink. So, but I think in time, that's what will happen. You know, in Carolina, they did something similar, not the team, but there was an area called North Hills Mall that was kind of old and run down, and they knocked that down and rebuilt that whole area. And now it's got like 5 major hotels, all kinds of restaurants and stuff. So I think that's what will happen in that Northgate area that we're building our practice rink in for sure.
I'm going to guess that, you know, Hartford, Carolina, you had to build a hockey base there. And that one of the things you probably were involved in was, conceptually at least, was building arenas, building ice surfaces so that people could play the game. Because we all know if you play, you're going to be a fan. Seattle has a long history of hockey. Is part of the plan with the Kraken to expand the number of ice surfaces that are available?
Well, I mean, I think it started with our practice facility. It would have been easy to build one sheet for us or two sheets if that's what we wanted, but the owners decided to put a third sheet in. So we have 3 sheets on our practice facility, which is a big significant and want to give back to the community in that regard. We've already had, you know, women's hockey and you know, sled hockey and men's leagues and Kraken junior Kraken tryouts and all kinds of stuff happening on the ice surface, which is great. I know they've worked with some of the other local, you know, hockey programs in the market and some of the other arenas to make sure that they're helping them and that those stay in business and we can grow the sport, not just in our backyard, but throughout the state of Washington. So that is the plan for sure.
That's a good question. Where do you think minor hockey is? How well developed is minor hockey, or in the United States they call it youth hockey? How well developed is youth hockey in the Seattle area?
I had a lot of discussions probably in the last year before COVID hit. We had some face to face stuff with the different youth hockey programs, and it seemed like it was pretty good, John. You know, there are some challenges, I think, especially through the pandemic and maybe some of the rinks sort of surviving just based on you know, the tough part of the you know, pandemic happening. But I know our group has met with a lot of those youth organizations to help try and structure that and build it with our 3 sheets here. We think that adds to it. One thing I've heard is when the kids sort of get to that 14, 15, 16 age group, a lot of them have to leave Seattle to go play in better markets. And I think what we're hoping is in time we can change that. You know, we want to build something here that not only people are able to stay and play in their backyard, but maybe other people want to come in and be a part of as well too. But certainly the junior programs with the Seattle Thunderbirds and the Everett Silvertips, you know, being close by, I think that sort of, if we can build that sort of liaison and sort of roll it into that Western Hockey League stuff, would be great for us moving forward.
Have the junior teams been receptive to what you've done and come to town? Because Everett particularly in Seattle, they do have really good fan bases, but you know, they've kind of owned the market.
Yeah, no, I know we've had different discussions with them. Todd especially has reached out you know, we're actually playing our exhibition games this year, not in our new arena, but in Kent with the Thunderbirds. And then we're playing at Everett with Silvertips, and then we're going to play in Spokane with the Chiefs there too. So we are, you know, trying to reach out and do things with them as well to help them moving forward.
The other aspect, I mean, every guy that you drafted, every guy that you've signed, every guy on the management side in hockey ops is a level playing field. How have you created an orientation for everybody to come to town? I mean, if I had signed a deal in Seattle and was part of your group, what would the organization have done for me to make sure that I understood what was going on in Seattle?
Yeah, so we worked hard on that ahead of the expansion draft because we knew once we drafted our guys, we had basically 60 days to explain the market and get them in here and get them settled. So we had a complete book and even actually in PDF form where we sent it out immediately to all our players that we drafted, all the people started working for us, explained kind of the city of Seattle, state of Washington, the different neighborhoods, what they had, where shopping was, where restaurants were, where doctors would be located, where school systems would be, all that kind of stuff to try and make it a lot easier for our people as they come in. And then we also had a moving company in place that we worked with. So, hey, this guy's in whatever, the state of Florida, the state of North Carolina, the state of the province of Ontario. We need to get them into town. How do we get them here most effectively and easiest for them and their family? And I will say our staff has worked extremely well on that. And so far, it's worked well. We're what, 10 days out from camp or so, you know, so it's exciting that it's right around the corner. And so far everybody's in town and seems to be enjoying what they're seeing.
I don't have to tell you that if your wife and your children are happy, you have a good life. And that's really the key to this, isn't it?
Well, that's what we're trying to do is make sure the wives understand, especially if they have, we have a lot of players with kids. So making sure where the school systems are, where the doctors will be locating, making sure that process, if they need a doctor, is pretty simple. If they want to bring their kids to the game, making sure that, you know, in our case, we're going to offer some babysitting so that they can bring their kids and have them sort of stay in the wives' room and be tended to while they watch the game, but yet they're still there with them in the facility.
This may sound like a stupid question, but I don't think I've ever asked it before. I just operate under the assumption that most players, when they come to a new city, and in the case of Seattle, a new team, would at least begin by renting rather than buying something. Is that the case, or do you know?
I think it's somewhat mixed. I think it depends on the term of the contract, whether guys feel more comfortable buying or renting. I think it does make sense in a lot of cases if you want to rent it, just sort of get to know the city better, yeah. Especially one of this size. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but I've heard from our guys probably more renting than buying, but there are people on both sides of that fence.
Ron Francis is with us, the general manager of the Seattle Kraken. We'll take a break, come back with more after these messages. Bob McCowan, it's John Shannon on the podcast and on Sirius XM. Ron Francis is with us, the GM of the
Come on, let's get into the team now. We got to get into this team now. We've done 20 minutes of stuff of Ronnie's nice stuff, and he's got the good speech going. Now let's get into the brass tacks.
Well, if you stop throwing softballs at him, then maybe we'll get some put some meat on the bone. Look, we talked. I mentioned George McPhee earlier, and there's, and I think you know this and understand this. There's inevitably going to be a comparison between your franchise and the Vegas situation, even though it was 4 years ago or whatever it was.
Right.
When you looked at what McPhee did in terms of strategically building the franchise, you couldn't exactly follow that blueprint even if you wanted to, because the situation is different. But he did take a different approach. Tell me what you think of what he did and how much might it have influenced the decisions that you and your organization made.
Yeah, no, I think you look back and what George and his team did was remarkable. You know, as you said, you know, a lot of the decisions they made affected us, but probably in a different way, and that we weren't going to be able to do the things that they did because, you know, the previous expansion before Vegas was in 2000, they were in 2017. So it was 17 years. A lot of the GMs hadn't been through it. The rules came into play. There were a new set of rules. I think the teams got them just over a year out. So they didn't have as much time to sort of jockey their roster or lineups to do it. And I think when guys look back on it, they'd say, okay, if I had to do that again, I would do it differently in this aspect or that aspect. In our case, it was 4 years previous that they had expansion. So these guys have been through the rules, understood them differently. You were in the middle of a pandemic with a flat cap. So that changed maybe sort of somehow their thinking and perspective as well too. So it was a totally different scenario for us. You know, the other thing with Vegas, they had nobody sitting on the outside that could affect the expansion draft. We had Vegas sitting on the outside who didn't lose a player to us in the expansion draft, but could affect the expansion draft and did. Ultimately, they made, I think it was two trades days before the expansion draft happened. So that affected, I think, three or four different teams' rosters at that point. Nothing they did wrong. Those were the rules, but there were certainly differences from when they went through it, from when we went through it. So to sit there and say we were going to get the same kind of ransom that Vegas got in a lot of the situations, I think was naive. You know, we tried to approach it from a different approach. We're asking our fans to pay a lot of money. If I was going to take on dead money or bad contracts, then it certainly had to be worth our time to do that. Otherwise, our plan was to try and go in a different direction and maintain as much salary cap as we could. And then potentially, you know, we could target guys during the expansion window where they, if they were a free agent that wasn't being protected, we could talk to, or a week later when we got to free agency, maybe trying to get some guys in that window as well.
Are you satisfied with the roster that you put together? As we sit here right now, or is it still a work in progress for you?
Well, I think it's always a work in progress. Sure. You know, I mean, when you look at teams, the hardest thing, and I think Vegas would say the same thing, the hardest thing is when teams protect seven forwards, they're going to protect their top six and they're going to protect their third line centerman. So it's hard to get kind of the elite high-end playmaking centerman that can affect your roster and your scoring, you know, easier than most other players in your lineup. So, I mean, that's an ongoing process for us for sure. But I think, you know, we were pleasantly surprised that Philip Grubauer became available on free agency day and we were able to get him. We think our goaltending is solid. We like our back end. We think our back end's good. And we think we've got an experienced group up front with also some young kids in the mix. And, you know, we think that we got a lineup that's going to work and compete hard every night. And we'll have to see how the scoring goes and the special teams go for us moving forward. But, you know, we're pleased with where we're at. We still have more work to do for sure.
Ronnie, you, the Grubauer signing, did you have your fingers crossed that he would be available on free agency when you drafted Driedger on expansion draft day? Did you have a concept that Grubauer would be available?
No, I mean, all those guys' names are out there, but 99% of them get signed by their own team prior to getting there. Like it was Grubauer and Landeskog. And so you're sitting there thinking, well, maybe we'll get, you know, a crack at one of those guys in free agency, but normally that doesn't happen. We were very comfortable with Driedger and Vanecek and Decord as our three goaltenders coming out of expansion. And then when that happened on free agency day, certainly we made the call and we're excited that we were able to get him signed with us. And that sort of, you know, in our minds, solidified our goaltending even further.
Well, I'm always, John and I have this conversation all the time. I'm always surprised that people in the sport, we all know how important goaltending is. You don't win anything if you don't have good goaltending. And of course, there are many variables and things that can happen over the course of a year that can impact what your plans were, but you better have a good goaltender if you're going to have any kind of success. And yet goaltenders are generally speaking, not drafted at the top of the draft. It's like you can't win in the NFL without a good quarterback. And everybody's looking for a quarterback at the top of the draft. As a guy who used to whistle pucks past goaltenders for a lot of years, can you explain to me why it's so difficult to draft an 18-year-old goaltender?
But I think you kind of answer your own question when you say 18 years old. I mean, that's the whole risk, right?
Ronnie, what's the difference between an 18-year-old goaltender and an 18-year-old defenseman? Because you'd also agree that a defenseman, generally speaking, you can't really judge them until they're 22, 24, 25 years old.
Yeah, no, I think the goaltending it comes with so much more pressure in that situation, right? As a young kid, and you draft a guy at 18 in the first round. I mean, there's been some that have turned out, some that haven't. It's like every other position, I guess, but
yeah,
especially with goaltenders, it's such a critical position. You know, you take them at 18 and there's a lot of pressure and added to them in that role. It's hard to project, I think, more so on a goaltender. There are some you feel pretty confident on, but it's a lot harder to project that guy moving forward. Whereas you may be able to find that guy in the third round or fourth round that's a little bit of a late bloomer, but has the size and the technique and is still going to sort of pan out. So it is a, you know, as a GM, you sleep a hell of a lot better if you have a good goaltender in between your pipes. But, you know, and there are times you look at, I mean, there's two drafted in the first round this year as well, right? So mm-hmm. There are guys that get drafted in the first round. It's just, it's challenging at 18 years old drafting anybody and projecting forward.
So do you think it's easier to teach, coach, develop a goaltender than it is a forward or defenseman?
Probably say harder.
Probably harder, huh?
Yeah, I mean, you're the last line of defense, right? If I'm a centerman, I make a mistake, my wingers can bail me out, or my defense can bail me out, or my goaltender can bail me out. If I'm a D and I make a mistake, my goalie can bail me out. If I'm the goaltender, I make a mistake, everybody's looking at me. And it takes a special breed to play that position. It takes a special mindset to be able to handle that sort of pressure, especially at the critical times over the course of the season into the playoffs. And I think it's just a lot harder position to play than the other ones, you know, because it's so zeroed in on and focused on knowing when you're doing well and when you're not.
Well, that'll do it for today. And that will do it for the best ofs for this holiday season.
And that will do it for 2021, Bob.
That is the end of 2021, and it couldn't come a moment too soon. I was hopeful that 2022 would be significantly better, but unfortunately, we're not exactly sure what it'll be.
No.
But we'll wade our way through it.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you and to everybody watching or listening to the program. Again, you can obtain it as a podcast, or of course, you can listen to it at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on Sirius XM, channel 167. For John Shannon, Bob McCowan, Happy New Year, y'all. See you on Monday.